Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
It's a Tuesday edition of Zero Block 30, and we have five rounds of the magazine, all of which come from you from... Well, we have six.
We do.
We have six.
Big six rounds.
Sorry. Oh, went down to the next page. Yeah. I apologize. Sneaky. Six rounds in the magazine. Round number one. The news that the Taliban were going to meet with Trump at Camp David the day before 9/11 caused a huge firestorm on the internet, but now the talks have stalled and they're not meeting at all, but we're going to talk about what all that means. Round number two, Army has launched an inquiry into how a teen with autism and arm disorders was recruited. Round number three, I'm going to walk you through a little bit of Admiral McRaven's book. We talked about it a little bit on Friday's show. He has a book called Make Your Bed. I believe that's what the book is entitled. We're going to talk about some of those lessons in leadership that he's learned over 30 years as a Navy SEAL. Round number four, ISIS is using cows as suicide bombers, but I hate that term because these beautiful, beautiful, unbelievably beautiful cows don't have a choice in the matter. They're actually murder bombers. Round number five, does the term, if it ain't raining, we ain't training, make you roll your eyes just a little bit? We get into a little PT talk with a poll from the ZBT Twitterverse. And finally, round number six, with the 18th anniversary of September 11th coming up this week, we'll be closing out the show by replaying the interview that we recorded last year with our guy Large. He lost his father along the attacks, and we're so grateful that he shared his story with us. And all of that is brought to you by our good friends at SeatGeek. Buying tickets can be complicated and confusing, but there's a simpler way to buy with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest and easiest way to get tickets to every single type of live event, whether you're going to the UTSA Army game like I will be with my young daughters on Saturday, or if you're going to a Broadway show, you should get your seats from SeatGeeks because they save you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And to get you the most bang for your buck, SeatGeek grades every single ticket based on the value to help you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. Guess how much... are you guys familiar with Andre Bocelli?
Sure.
He is coming to San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
Guess how much the cheap seats are?
My guess would be fairly expensive because he's super famous.
Bear in mind that it's in San Antonio.
How much do you think? $150.
Cheapest ones I can find were $225.
Oh, wow, man.
That's impressive. I mean, he's a living legend.
He is.
So I get it. But yeah.
Celine's not going to be in there with him.
Oh.
It's just going to be Andre.
Doesn't he sing the Catalina Wine Mixer song?
Mm-hmm. He might, yeah. That might be him.
When he sings Ave Maria.
Oh, that's just beautiful.
I'm dripping wet. Well, anyways, you can get all kinds of different tickets by going to the SeatGeek app and in the promo code CHAPS today. That's promo code CHAPS to get, not promo chode, but promo code CHAPS to get $10 off. Last time, it was making me way too dry. It like dried out everything. Now it's giving me the opposite of dry mouth. I have saliva mouth.
Ooh.
Big time.
So you're just worrying about spitting in everybody's face when you're talking to them.
It feels like somebody shot their load in my mouth and I'm just gargling jizz at all times during the day.
Now would be the time to do a saltine eating contest or something.
Yeah.
Or like the cinnamon challenge.
There is a whole box of fortune cookies in the fridge out there.
Well, now would be the time to challenge somebody.
There would be.
Big Ev.
For sure. Mm. Cons, let's address the elephant in the room. What happened with your boys?
Well,
that made me uncomfortable.
Yeah. Go ahead. it's a tough pill to swallow when you lose a football game anytime, but some losses are harder than others, and this is certainly one of those ones where it was real heartbreak because I think anybody who watched the game would tell you Army mostly played better than Michigan. Army lost that game as opposed to Michigan winning that game, and for a program that went through so many dark years, and now we've come out of that dark time. Last year, we went to overtime with Oklahoma, and that was kind of like, hey, we got to play real perfect to even have a chance. And we played perfect, and some bounces went our way. Now we're to a point with our team where we went into that game, and I was expecting to win the game. And we didn't even play that well, and we still had chances to win. And then I just have to point this out. when you guys started texting me, specifically you, Chaps, in the third quarter, we're moving down the field, and we got second and one, or second and goal on the one, and you're like, hey, listen, if Army wins, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and I'm like, I really want to just text back, shut up. Please stop.
But you know I know exactly what I was doing.
Yeah, I know.
Karma came back to bite you, too.
It did. It did. We'll get into that,
too. It was brutal. And then we throw that interception, which was not great because we got a motion penalty. Ultimately, you know, we don't need to rehash the entire game because I think I've rehashed it now 20 times, and it just continues to sting the more I talk about it. But, man, sports are the best, but also the worst.
But it gave me the opportunity to write the best types of blogs. And Brent actually brought it to my attention. He's like, sometimes your best blogs are your audience of one blog.
Yeah.
Where you write a blog where you have a very specific person that you want to read it.
Yes.
When I got to read or write the Army Wins the Game
Yeah, blog. And I want you to know, so I have alerts set up for certain people at the company when they publish blogs. Yeah. You're one of them.
Yeah.
So I think we're still in the overtime, first overtime, and I get this notification and I see the title of the blog. I wanted to throw my phone. I was so angry at you.
Dude, even people that I've been friends with for years reached out and they're like, is my stream behind? Like,
what happened?
And I'm like, no, it's still overtime. Like, the game's not over. Yeah, it was just for cons.
That was just tough.
But it bit me in the ass because Nick Foles broke his clavicle.
Sorry to see that because he's such a likable guy.
Yeah,
but what are you going to do? But and then probably the worst part about the game, and you guys have been to games with me now. You see how animated I get, especially Chaps, the first year we went, where I recovered that fumble during the Army-Navy game.
It's a nightmare.
I am extremely animated, especially at the beginning of games, and there were certain points in this game where I wanted to jump out of my skin and cheer, but I was sitting in the press box, and I was sitting there, and I couldn't say a word. It was the worst.
Those feelings that I texted you were legit and accurate. Whenever you said that you were in there, I almost threw my phone. I was like, this guy is the worst guy to be in the press box. Kate, have you ever watched it from the press box?
Hell no. No, I've never been invited anywhere fancy during games.
It sounds fancy, though, right? Like,
it does.
The idea of going to the press box whenever you're a fan and you don't work in media, you're like, man, the press box got to be cool. You're sitting right on the 50. You have the best vantage point to actually see the game, which you don't. I remind people who actually know and like football that the best spot to watch it from is the end zone. That's how I feel. Like, you can actually see the gaps and how, like, the offensive linemen are moving and things like that. But you have a great vantage point from any press box. But those people are the worst.
Yeah.
And they're everybody who does traditional media coverage, loser. That's a terrible job. You should be able to be excited if there's a big touchdown.
Especially because all the people sitting in front of me, they were Michigan journalists. So clearly they want Michigan to win. So I wouldn't have cared if they cheered during the game. Get excited. Who gives a shit? But I had a pit in my stomach, and then I went out to the stands, and I'm sitting among all the Michigan fans. My hands were shaking. You're like, go live. I'm like, I physically, this will suck.
Yeah, that would have been much better.
Yeah.
Kind of just shaking.
Yeah.
Like, I was going to say Michael J. Fox, but I'll refrain.
Yeah. Dude, and then, oh my gosh. Even in the overtime.
You didn't make the joke.
Right. No, okay. No.
Even in the overtime, we score the first overtime. I'm like, all right, maybe we could still get this done. And then held them to a field goal, but then it was just not meant to be.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do?
Right,
so they lost. Okay.
Catherine, how was your weekend?
The Eagles won.
Yeah.
So
Birds played a heck of a game. Heck of a second half.
The Eagles won.
That was a big brass show.
It was great. Danced around. Was grooving and moving. Was right up front. So had my brass band time. Yeah. Only ripped a couple sigs. I'm back to the counters. Back to zero.
Oh, all right. Thank you for your honesty.
I only had a few.
All right. Making progress.
I did considerably well, all things taken into account.
Very Can I nice say one other thing? I'm sorry.
Sure.
Going back to the Army of Michigan, just because of what we do, I had tweets, videos,
That's
t-shirts.
Worst,
I had it
man.
All planned out in my head. Dave tweeted one thing about Michigan. He something about waking a sleeping giant. I was all ready to hit reply on, they should go back to sleep. I was ready to be fired up and just shove it in everybody's face, and then nothing.
Yep.
Not great.
That stinks, man. It really does. I'm disappointed for you.
Yeah.
For sure.
But we got a big game coming up this week.
You do.
Do we want to talk about the wager, or we want to wait till next episode?
Let's talk about it on Friday show.
Okay, sounds good.
We'll do it on Friday show. All right, let's get into the actual topics of the day. This is probably the big story over the last few days. It really popped up, I believe, on Thursday, maybe even late Friday, something like that. But a lot more details came out from various different types of media outlets, I would say, across the board, one of which was President Trump himself. Kate, you want to walk us through what he said?
Yeah, and first, I feel like a bunch of different shows over the last few months have been like, hey, guess what? U.S. and Taliban are in round three of peace talks. And then a few episodes later, round five of peace talks, round eight of peace talks, whatever. So, but finally, it looks like things are coming to a head. And Taliban members were going to come over here to Camp David to actually sit down with President Trump himself and really talk things out. So it seemed like, holy shit, could we actually really be at the end here? But then these tweets came out from Donald Trump. Unbeknownst to almost everyone, the major Taliban leaders and, separately, the president of Afghanistan were going to secretly meet with me at Camp David on Sunday, this past weekend. They were coming to the United States tonight. Unfortunately, in order to build false leverage, they admitted to an attack in Kabul that killed one of our great, great soldiers and 11 other people. I immediately canceled the meeting and called off peace negotiations. What kind of people would kill so many in order to seemingly strengthen their bargaining position? They didn't. They only made it worse. If they cannot agree to a ceasefire during these very important peace talks and would even kill 12 innocent people, then they probably didn't have the power to negotiate a meaningful agreement anyway. How many more decades are they willing to fight? And that was a series of three tweets that he sent out over the weekend. And
can I say something quickly?
Sure.
That's one of the stronger unbeknownst that I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, yeah.
Unbelievable use of unbeknownst. Because
everyone.
It's just an absolute stunt that I have top level security. Mm-hmm. You don't. Mm-hmm. You didn't know about this. It's unbeknownst to almost everyone. We get it, dude. You're the president. You're privy to a lot of information.
Sure. A lot of things.
Unbeknownst.
Often.
And it just, a lot of people. People picked up on tons of various different parts. There's a lot to break down in these tweets, but one of them was there was a camp that was super angry that we would ever negotiate with. Well, we've been trying to do this in Obama's era, in this era. We've been trying to work something out for a hot minute. So it's not just Republicans are talking to their Democrat, whatever. But then other people were like, you were having them over right before 9/11? Not a great feeling. Not a big fan of that right there. So I think just the... It's like one of those things sometimes where you look at an ad campaign and they're like, how did it get through so many people that they gave the okay on that?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, how did that timing get through to so many people too? But again, you never know what the behind the scenes. But yeah, this is a huge deal that basically, like, what does it mean? Are we back to square one with peace talks? Is everything ruined? Like, what does this mean?
And a little bit of behind the scenes, we were actually talking, the three of us were talking about, how do we break this story down? Because there is a lot of bias whenever you talk about news outlets and how they cover it, whether it's an editorial or an op-ed or whatever. So we wanted to go with the most liberal publication that we could possibly find in order to give you the news straight from the facts. That always liberal Stars and Stripes.
Oh,
pods.
So libo. God, total
wanna,
libs over at Stars and Stripes.
Yeah. Those libtards, you want to talk to us about what they said?
Right. So Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Sunday that the Taliban overreached with a car bomb attack in Kabul that killed an American soldier, spurring President Donald Trump to call off closely held Afghanistan peace talks planned for Camp David. Pompeo said the Trump administration has recalled envoy Salmé Khalilzad, who had been negotiating with Taliban leaders for months in Qatar, and it would be up to the insurgent group whether talks will resume. Critics denounced Trump's plan to hold the Camp David meeting just days before the 18th anniversary of the September 11th, 2001 attacks, and they said Trump was giving legitimacy to extremists who are responsible for the deaths of more than 2,400 U.S. service members in America's longest war. Pompeo said Trump wanted to look the Taliban leaders, quote, in the eye, while Khalilzad worked to finalize an agreement that would allow the U.S. to start withdrawing troops. Pompeo defended Trump's planned talks, saying the presidential retreat in Maryland was an appropriate place, given that it had been the venue for Mideast peace negotiation and other diplomatic meetings.
I'll also say, I feel like Camp David would be the best place because the Taliban, they always have their, like, their terror camps.
Sure.
Imagine they come to Camp David and they're like, what?
This is your campsite?
This is a camp? Wait a minute. You can have fun camps too? Is this, you know, are those fishing poles?
You know what they should have done instead of Camp David? You know when you drive down like 95 and you have like the Yosemite Sam spots where it'll have like Yogi Bear on the side? That's where they should go, like, this is Camp David?
Like holy shit, a camp. Like, we should take them to the kind of camp where they're having a great time and they're like, it doesn't have to be bad. Like, things don't have
camp.
To be so miserable all the time.
Camp.
What's the blob? Is the Taliban guy? One's laying on the edge of the blob, another jumps off. Woo!
Oh, man, that would be good.
We've been doing it all wrong. Yeah, I feel like that was a strong, strong spot to be.
But I understand why people, I think that's enough of the background on the story. I think I understand both sides. One, I don't care if they have the negotiations inside the White House if it gets us to withdraw from Afghanistan.
Right. Yes.
Like, to me, there's been so many people, we've been one, like, we just want the Afghan war to end. If it takes coming to Camp David to get it done, I don't give a fuck,
right.
ultimately.
Right.
Is the timing bad? Yes. But there's never going to be a good time. And people that get wrapped up around anniversaries, and I understand that that's going to be a large swath of people, I don't feel that way. I think if you can end it now. But why stop at 5,000? To me, that's a half measure. And I don't believe that we should be a government where we are involved with half measures. If we're going to do it, just fucking withdraw.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, though, I get canceling these talks. That car bomb killed Sergeant First Class Ellis A. Barreto Ortiz, 34 years old, the fourth U.S. service member killed in Afghanistan in the last 2 weeks. And he was killed along with a Romanian service member, 10 civilians. And this is one of many bombings the Taliban's done in recent days. Mm-hmm. So I also fuck them. Like, fuck them.
Oh, yeah,
so
but it's
hard.
Always
like,
been fuck the
exactly.
Taliban.
We got to do something different at this point. We have to.
But okay, but the peace talks then, if they are actively doing all these peace talks with us, why the fuck are they still doing this shit? Like, I don't understand.
Right,
I'm just so lost in this whole thing.
I totally agree with what you're saying, Kate, like, because I don't think that the Taliban, even if you're coming over from Qatar and you are here, you're still – people in the Taliban and fucking Al-Qaeda aren't going to listen to their elected officials like in the Taliban. Mm-mm. Like, that's the nature of extremism and what they're doing. They are not going to stop ever.
Right. And I wish President Trump just hadn't tweeted about this at all. Had he just kept it a secret?
We could pin that and make it a drop.
Right.
Yeah, that could be evergreen sentence right there.
I think every single elected Republican official was like, yes, absolutely.
Just keep it unbeknownst to everyone. Because I do think they have to sit down with these people and try to broker some sort of agreement, because whatever we've been doing hasn't worked for 18 years.
Yeah, because we had these talks. Like, there was a video that popped up. I'll have Bryn drop in the audio. We'll drop it in now. Here's the audio from President Bush.
And we're making steady progress toward achieving our objective, and we will continue to make progress. You can't negotiate with these people. You can't try to talk sense to these people. The only one way to deal with them is to find them and bring them to justice. And that's what the United States and a lot of other countries working with the United States will continue to do.
And basically, that was even in movies and lines all across. How many movies have featured the line, we don't negotiate with terrorists?
Right.
We do. We
have. I mean, it just sounds cool to say while you're ripping sunglasses off your face. You know, it's like a cool movie line. But the reality is that we do. And now the Afghan government is saying, we do not believe these talks are going to continue between the U.S. and Taliban. And the Taliban said Americans are going to be the ones who suffer from Trump's cancellation of the talks. I just, fucking A. It's just so frustrating because, again, there's so many lives on the line and so many – I just
think you have to do something different at this point.
Right.
When President Bush said in 2001, which you just heard, when he says, we're not going to negotiate, period. This is not a negotiation. You are going to do these things or we are going to kick your ass, essentially.
Yes.
Right. That worked in 2001. Bubba, it's 2019.
Yeah.
Right.
We've been there for a long fucking time. I've talked myself into it while we're on the podcast.
Right.
Right.
Bring them, dude. Like, if we can end this thing, I don't care if I have to go suck somebody's dick. We will end the war in Afghanistan.
There's a drop, too.
Yeah.
But I think it just goes to show.
Put on the screen Andy from the Fire Festival behind us. We'll bring him in.
Exactly.
That's how we end this thing in Afghanistan.
God, dude, just fucking leave.
Because
what do we get?
And I think it's important to note that we need to try something different, because clearly they don't give a shit. If they're going to use terror as their leverage and just continue to kill people, they clearly don't care about anybody's life. They just want to have that upper hand.
The Taliban?
Yeah. They don't care. They don't care. But so the fact that they're going to continue to use these tactics, we have to do something very drastic at this point.
But what? Like,
I don't understand. Like, I think that makes the cyclical nature keep going and going and going. Like, we're going to do another surge?
Right.
Like,
I don't know that it's a surge, but it has to be. No, I'm just saying it has to be something different, because everything we've tried to this point.
I think the thing different, just fucking leave. Like, they're not going to stop.
That's different.
Yeah.
That's different.
All right. We're going to go around in circles. We're not going to go to Camp David and solve this right now. Let's move
however,
on.
Can I say
however,
something? Totally separate note.
What?
I do picture Camp David like a summer camp.
So,
I'm not all right.
So that's what I was going to say. My biggest frame of reference for Camp David is from the West Wing. It really looks like a nice place to go for the weekend. So
you guys haven't been?
No, sorry.
Oh
yeah,
that's right.
Sorry.
You've been.
Can you can you inform us of
Do
what it's like?
Do you think it's beautiful?
I would if you guys had the clearance. Let's move on to round two.
Oh, cold.
Unbeknownst to you, I've been. Round number two is one of those stories when it pops up on social media that I legit had like a visceral reaction when I saw it, where I was legit mad online and rage. You're like, how does this happen? Kate, you want to walk us through this story?
Yeah. So the Army has launched an inquiry into circumstances that led 19-year-old Garrison Horsley, who was on anxiety medication, diagnosed with autism and congenital arm disorders, to report to basic combat training at Fort Jackson in South Carolina this past August. The young man's father told Army Times he had been trying to get his son back to Idaho, like actively trying to get his son back out of the Army and back home after reaching out to various officials and congressional representatives. After his son reported to basic training, he began having anxiety attacks and was quickly separated from his unit to be out-processed for not disclosing his myriad of diagnosed disorders. Both the father and son say the Army recruiter encouraged him to hide potentially disqualifying factors in order to enlist as a human resources specialist. And I mean, so many people, we've talked about on the show before, my recruiter told me to hide that I'd broken my back and hide that I had smoked marijuana before. Mm-hmm. And I did. I listened to him and I hit it, and it ended up working out fine for me. But I also know plenty of other people who were told actively by their recruiters to hide things.
Oh, dude, if you are enlisted in the military and your recruiter didn't tell that, I would be shocked.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like, the lying culture that happens in recruiting stations is unbelievable. There was recently a friend of mine who they wanted to have their daughter go into the Air Force, and they said that they told whenever she was going to MEPS that she was on anxiety medicine when she was 12 and 13 years old. Instant disqualifier.
Yeah.
Like, if you admit it, they would never know. Like, right. They're not going to subpoena your records. And in my like still military brain, I was like, why in the fuck would you tell them?
Right.
Like, why would you tell them? Like, that's the way that it's been forever. And so many of the stories, so many of the reaction that we've seen on like military social media has been attacking the recruiter. I blame the way that the culture of climate is on the pressure behind these recruiters to meet their numbers. It's not something like, you didn't meet your numbers, oh well, Johnny, come back again next week or next month and we'll try it again.
Yeah.
You get legitimate like charges for your career
and that can affect
everything.
Yeah.
So you have to get in as many people, but, and they constantly do it. I blame MEPS.
That's
this is
where,
a MEPS,
though,
MEPS issue.
I can see the pressure on them. I can see, Kate, okay, don't say you smoke marijuana. Your back's fine now. Don't mention it. That, like, I get it. I totally get it. But this, and I think all of us can say we've served with people who, you know, and I'm not disparaging them, but you look at the struggles they're having and they're looking back now in hindsight 2020 and knowing so much more about different disorders and things like that, going, that person should have never, it's almost cruel that
PFC
they had
winter.
To go through the military.
Winter should have not have been in the Marine Corps.
Because they suffer. They suffer. It's not, yelling at them is not going to fix it. Hazing them is not going to fix it. It's something so much deeper than that. And like you said, an E5 isn't going to be able to point out when someone's heavily on the spectrum or when somebody's this or somebody's that. And no, they're just going to keep, why I keep yelling at them, they're not fixing themselves. Like, it's, that's what happens, and it makes their lives miserable. And I feel like that's a failure, because I think all of us, I can think of two people off the top of my head who really struggled when they were in, and in hindsight, I'm like, oh, there was so much more going on than they were just a shit bag. You know what I mean?
Take the autism out of it, though. Horsley said himself, my left arm is 50% weaker than my right, but I got a waiver for that. I've never been able to do a pull-up in my life, and I max out on push-ups at 15 or 10. I can't turn my hand palm up.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Why would you even attempt to join the military if you have that physical limitation? I'm sorry to say, but
I think this will result in changes, like in how that they do things, because it has to grab the attention of high level leaders. Like, not just, this wasn't just the E5 that fucked up. This was the E7. This was the E9. Like, the major that's in the recruiting station, all of them fucked up.
And all of the people before them that perpetuated
that severe,
this culture.
You should know. Like, you do PT with your recruiting station before you go in. The dude can't do one pull-up.
So if you can only do 15 push-ups, you're never going to be able to pass a PT test. So how are you going to have any semblance of a career, even if it's only 3 or 4 years?
I felt bad because the father, Ryan Horsley, said that he disagreed and was afraid with the enlistment prospect, but he didn't imagine his son was going to be able to get all the way through the medical and screening process. So I feel like it's one of the things where you don't want to hold your kid back. Mm. They have this dream. You don't want to tell
him. No, you're absolutely
like,
right.
But you trust the process will, and so that way at least he can say, hey, I tried.
And we don't know, like, what level of autism it is either. Like, it could be something that where they're lightly on the spectrum of having autism. And I think that as a parent, like, for me, for example, if my kid had, like, ADHD or something like that, and there was a job that I knew most likely wouldn't be a good match for her, but she came home and she said, Dad, this is really what I want to do. I'm not going to sit her down and be like, hey, you have ADHD pretty bad. You should probably temper your expectations. No, I'm going to push her forward to do whatever she wants to do and try.
Because that's your job as a parent, to be that support system.
The military should say no. It's not
the parents'
responsibility.
Say no, I'm sorry, you cannot join the military.
Right.
And that doesn't make the Horsley a bad person. It's just the military is not for everybody.
Yeah.
Plain and simple.
I don't know. Bren, you had thoughts about this, right?
Yeah, my best friend's little brother is autistic, and I mean, like, very autistic.
Yeah.
This is not something where, like, even going to a recruiting station is even possible. And, you know, he likes guns. He likes, like, action movies. He'll run around, like, shooting fake guns and all that kind of stuff. And the prospect of a recruiter even thinking, like, hey, I might be able to boost my numbers by even sliding this kid through the system, that broke my heart because that should never happen in the first place.
Yeah.
I understand, like, the MEPS problem that they need to boost their numbers, but have some fucking integrity,
right,
dude.
This sounds like a case
have some
where it's
fucking
above
integrity.
That, and it's like, oh, come on, guys.
And I really, like, shiver to think about what he went through whenever he wasn't able to adapt, because the drill sergeants there, they're not,
they just
not,
assume you can do it.
You're not fucking trained. You, as a drill instructor, you're not responsible to do a mental health evaluation on a kid.
Right.
Like, your job is to get them through.
Right.
And so somebody with autism, you're yelling at them. Does that is the least effective method of doing it. Like, it's just asinine. What a fucking terrible story.
To Brent's point, it's kind of crummy because as a recruiter, once you push them through, that's it. You're gone from the equation.
Right.
You don't have to worry about that person anymore.
Yeah.
So it's like out of sight, out of mind. So it's a little.
I think these folks will
that.
Have something to worry about.
Right.
Yeah.
They definitely will.
Circle back on that.
Well, I hope whatever is in the future for Horsley, for this kid, I hope is great. But I'm glad that he's. I wasn't clear from the story. Is he back home yet? Is he still stuck in this out processing
world? It said
world,
an August 30 memo signed by Horsley's primary care physician states that the young man was being treated for a mild episode of recurrent depressive order in addition to the autism, a part of his current medical issues, and that will lead to a medical board.
So
which,
he's still
you know,
on the way out.
In reality, if he gets med boarded and they put, I hate to be like, there's going to be some good that's coming out of it. This kid is definitely going to get retired, like medically retired from the military.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he'll have benefits. He'll be able to go to the VA. He'll do all those things and have, like, legitimate health insurance for the rest of his life because his recruiter fucked up, and he'll probably get a check from the VA forever, which good for him. He deserves it after what he's fucking been through. All right, let's move on to round three because I want to, especially after this, I want to talk a little lessons in leadership.
Oh.
Round number three. One of the things I really like about military that probably was the most valuable to me was lessons in leadership. And being that Admiral McRaven is a UT Austin guy, he's a Texas guy, I've recently started reading his book that is entitled Make Your Bed. And now it gets a little bit more extreme, little things that can change your life and maybe even the world.
Mm.
We talked a little bit about it on Friday's episode where he says that making your bed, once you do that, you get up, you make your bed, you already have something checked off for the day. So you're already starting your day on a positive note. Well, his second chapter in the book talks about that you can't do things by yourself. That's one of the things that we've talked about on ZBT a lot is that your platoon, the people that you're around, not necessarily your actual 39 man and woman platoon, but you're the people that you surround yourself with are very important to how you cope with mental issues, how you adjust back to normal civilian life and things like that. Well, McRaven takes it a little bit further. And in his story, he talks about how at Buds, every single SEAL relies on everybody.
Mm-hmm.
That there was days, like, because of the training is months long, he woke up with the flu and still had to go into the 40-degree water. He woke up sick, still had to go on the runs. On those days, the other people, the other seven guys on your SEAL team, have to pick up the slack a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about how learning how to lean on people when you need them is very important in his life. He later went on to talk about a story where his wife was a big inspiration to him. And this story is fucking wild. So SEALs and recon and Rangers and things like that, they constantly are jumping out of planes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Constantly. So at the time, Admiral Craven was in charge of every single Navy SEAL team that was on the West Coast. He was so very experienced. Yeah. I say that to say that he was very experienced. He had jumped out of a bunch of fucking planes.
Yeah.
So they were doing a training mission one day. They jumped out of the back of a C-130, and he's just cruising down, just going down. Well, somebody went into a lane below him and opened up their parachute.
Mm-hmm.
And when they did, like, picture when a parachute opens, the first thing that it does, it's almost act like an airbag where it pops open.
Yep.
Huge.
Well, he was at, speaking of the fat blob at Fat Camp with the Ben Stiller movie, he got shot back up into the air while he was still in the air and hadn't pulled his own. So it knocked him unconscious while while he was dropping at like 1,000 feet a second or something like that.
Not great.
So he it pops him back into the air. He regains consciousness in the air, has the wherewithal while he's spinning to look at his altimeter,
mm-hmm.
and he sees that he's falling too fast, like that he's getting too close to the ground. He needs to pull his chute. Well, because when he's spinning, he pulls the chute. Somehow the lines get wrapped around his leg,
mm-hmm.
and the way that it pulls him whenever it gets wrapped around his leg tore all of the muscles in his abdomen, tore everything away from his sternum. He had every single muscle from his legs was ripped open. He said that he tore thousands of muscles at the same time.
Oh, God.
And he said it was the single loudest that he's ever screamed in his entire life. He gets to the ground immediately. Like, he lands so far. He lands 2 miles away from the landing spot where he's supposed to be. And the paramedics bring him to the hospital. He's in. He has to get metal plates attached to his sternum in order to reattach the muscles. So he's sitting there in bed, knowing that he's going to be in bed for a long time when mm-hmm. you have an injury mm-hmm. that traumatic. And he knows, he thinks about what typical military injuries you think about. Not only am I going to have months-long rehab, but I'm also going to be severe pain, mm-hmm. and my career is probably over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Especially as a SEAL. Like,
right.
Like, you think about your career being over when you have an injury that traumatic.
Yeah.
Well, he gets discharged from the hospital, and they tell him that it's going to be 4 or 5 months until he can actually move on and start to be almost normal again. And like any person that's going through severe type of injury, he gets down. Like, he gets, like, clinically depressed. And his wife tells him, like, you have done incredibly difficult things in your life. You have helped the country in so many ways. Now it's my job to help you. Whatever mm-hmm. you need, I'm going to be here for you. Mm-hmm. But we're not going to do this sad sex, Sally. We're going to attack this like it's a mission, and you're going to overcome, and you're going to be a SEAL again. Well, he was, and he was the SEAL commander who was in charge of the Osama bin Laden raid, and he went on to have an incredibly successful career. But I think that those points are very well said.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, it is about other people around you mm-hmm. and making sure that you're surrounded by good people.
No, I mean, you can't point to anyone in history who has been successful and then not point to people that were around them who helped them get to that level of success.
If I was his wife, I would have been like, we're going to get you better just so we can find the man who opened his chute beneath you, and we're going to beat his ass together as a team. That would be my motivation.
But he said he could, like, see it. Like, as soon as it happened, like, he looked down at the moment. He was God. Like, fuck. And he said that he tried to shoot away and like to get out of the way, but it hit him just at the right spot. He said it was the worst pain of his life. I can't even imagine.
No.
Hell,
like, you talk about ripping
away. I wanted to throw up in my mouth when you were saying it. I'll be honest. That really got to me.
Let me ask you this.
How did he not lose his leg?
I know. It's crazy. Yeah.
Medical.
I mean, they're lucky that it happened. Miracle. They said that they were only like 3 miles away from like a state-of-the-art facility in San Diego where they had like on-call trauma surgeons that had specialized. He got lucky at many, many steps along the way. Because if he wouldn't have woke up, I mean, think.
All right, change his socks. Give him a Motrin.
Yeah, it said that the parachute hit him at 150 miles an hour coming out.
Jesus.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even think that a parachute, because obviously a parachute is soft, it's cloth. You wouldn't think something like that.
But think about, have you ever been in a wreck where the airbag pops out?
Yeah.
It's essentially the same thing. It's just a huge-ass airbag.
Right, sure. Okay. See if you guys agree with this statement. I would put more credence to Admiral McRaven's leadership philosophy versus people in business that have written books about leadership. I think his leadership principles are more transferable either way versus people in business that can try to.
I think a lot of the principles are the same. Like, I think principles in leadership are very cross the board type of thing. The one thing about guys like McRaven is that the stories are just so much more interesting.
Right.
Like, it's a lot more interesting to be like, I was falling out of a fucking plane, my legs were damn near ripped off my body, and then I recovered, and now I'm still a badass.
Right.
Because of leadership.
Yeah.
That's a lot more interesting than, so there I was, walking down Wall Street one day, and a fucking car hit me.
That's fair.
Unless
there's cocaine and strippers involved.
True.
In the Wall Street version. Thank you.
Excellent point. So we'll be going through some of McRaven's, maybe not every week, but from time to time, because I think those are important, and they're things that I really enjoy.
Are you McRaven a little leadership?
I am. And if you're listening, Admiral, come on the fucking show, dude. I've reached out to you like 10 times. No return email.
Sir.
Nothing?
Sir.
Yeah, you expect more, right?
Sir. Yes.
I mean, I like you. You return every email that you get.
I go through my DMs all the time, every email. I respond to every single one.
Let's put that to the test. Cons at Barstool Sports. Just ask him a random question about your fantasy football team. I think that'll be the homework for the listeners this week.
Oh, can't wait.
All right, let's.
We're also looking for interns, so send all your internship applications to cons@barstoolsports.com.
All right, let's move on to round four. Round four is brought to you by our friends at CB Distillery. If you've got health concerns, you owe it to yourself to see what CBD can do for you. CBD may offer many of the health benefits of marijuana, but without the high, it's 100% legal and requires no prescription when you shop at cbdistillery.com. Listen to what the customers say. They have 5-star reviews all over the place. They say that I highly recommend CBD to everyone. I've done a complete turnaround for me. Another customer wrote, it's an excellent product that makes a difference in my health. And they said that I will never do without CBD again. It's worked 100% for me. If you haven't tried CBD for whatever health concerns you have, you really should. Whether you get your CBD, where you get your CBD products is crucial. With independent lab results and nearly 250,000 customers, CBDDistillery.com are the folks I trust. You got health concerns, you owe it to yourself to see what CBD can do for you. Go to CBDDistillery.com and enter ZBT for 20% off. Again, enter ZBT for 20% off at CBDDistillery.com, CBDDistillery.com. Round number four, let's talk about fucking murder cows.
Murder cows.
Cons, you want to walk us through a story?
Yeah. This is really kind of sad if you're a lover of animals.
Oh.
I think Kate's a little upset about this one.
No, man. I crush burgers.
Okay. Anyway, Islamic State militants in Iraq used cows strapped with explosive vests in a recent bombing operation. At least 2 cows were seen with explosive vests in the southeastern Iraqi village of Al-Asal. That was not pronounced correctly. How am I saying this one?
Al-Isla.
Sorry. Where they were then remotely detonated when they were close to homes, a provincial police commander said. The cows, which could cost more than $1,200 each, were killed and homes were damaged.
That's a cheap cow, by the way.
Yes.
That's a cheap cow.
But I mean, over in Iraq, that could be a hot patootie. That could be a hot number.
I think that's very expensive in Iraq. Yeah.
Yeah.
No humans were believed to be harmed in the incident.
Okay. First of all, you're a cow. You're just cruising through
bitch,
the day.
I'm a cow.
You're like, hey, bitch, I'm a cow. Can we play that song again? But you're having a nice day. Mm-hmm. You're munching on some grass. Suddenly, a couple Taliban dudes come upon you. You're like, what the fuck is this? You're looking, they're strapping something to you, and you realize. You're like, oh,
you think you finally made it as a horse. You're
right.
Like, they're finally going to ride me.
They're finally.
I'm bigger.
They're not
I can
in the bad way that
ropes.
Some people over there tend to do.
And they're like, they named me. They start calling me Doja Cat. This is awesome.
And then, so this, but also, I just feel like cows, though, like, I can see strapping one to a horse, slapping that horse's butt, and letting it gallop somewhere, like, right into whatever. That's very dark.
Right.
But a cow, like, a cow's not going to be like, all right, here we go. Like, huh?
Yeah, train a cow.
Try and train a cow.
Well, you said you can train any animal, right?
No, not any animal. I did have a cat for a while that I was training how to sit and roll over, and it was awesome.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think
to what you said earlier, I feel like cows are expensive. I don't feel like they have expendable cows.
The whole move is just strange. Also, I feel like if I was over there and I saw a cow with a vest strapped to it, I'd be like, hey, that's no good. And I'd slowly walk away from it because I'd still get away from it in time. I don't understand that at all.
Because then you got to make it blend in. You got to put inert vest on everybody else, like, essentially, so it makes it look like you're just, maybe the people think that this is a super woke farmer that has, like, cooling vests. Maybe that's what it is. It's designed to look like a cooling vest. Like, wow, these cows have been suffering heat stroke for a long time.
We know that, obviously, they've been doing vehicle-borne IEDs and also strapping them on themselves in tons of different cases in both Iraq and Afghanistan and around the Middle East. But for animals, that's also been a thing. In 2013, a Taliban suicide bomber riding on a donkey killed several NATO troops in Afghanistan, because I feel like you don't really see that coming. I feel like you're like, huh. But we also, they also used to tell us to look out for carcasses on the side of the road.
Big time. Because
they would hide bombs in like a bloated donkey corpse.
Do you know the reason why they did that?
Why?
Because dog handlers were really hesitant to allow their dogs to go up to carcasses.
Right.
So in order to get past like IEDs and shit like that, like for me, I imagine myself, if there's a dead buzzard or there's a dead animal on the side of the road that has an IED on it, naturally the dog's instinct is going to go check out what stinks really bad. Like,
right.
They're going to go smell it anyways.
Yeah.
So as the handler, I'm not thinking that there's a bomb in there, right? When that first starts happening, you're just pulling your dog away, always pulling to it because it's dead.
Right. Mm. I just, the whole thing is just bizarre, but it got me thinking too. Has PETA heard about this? Because I feel like that might get
them
to mobilize, head over there, could turn the tide of the war. A couple billboards with Pamela Anderson
and
the
nude.
They
don't want to deal those crazies.
Got full nips out to save the donkeys.
That'd be awesome.
I feel like they'd be captivated.
Pam Anderson, the goat.
Yeah, so I feel like something could really happen there. But the Times also suggested that this recent attack was a sign that the Islamic State wanted to preserve the lives of its members who might otherwise die in a suicide bombing. So they're so short on personnel that they're actually using these cows.
Bring me
like,
another suicide bomber. We are out. Yeah.
We are straight
we're fresh
out, buddy. We're
like,
fresh
Carl
out.
Said no, man. Carl's out. He said absolutely not.
Right. And this all came amid an assessment from the DOD Inspector General warning that ISIS could be resurfacing in the light of the U.S.'s decision to withdraw troops from Syria. And I feel like that's a no shit. They're like cockroaches. They're going to keep coming out. But they're definitely hurting if they're using cows as their suicide bombers at this point.
Do you think that they go with like short straw? Like who's going to be a suicide bomber?
Oh, yeah.
I would say no, because I do think that those people believe their lives begin after death. So that's why it's surprising that they're running out of people to do this, because usually these people are running at the chance to be a suicide bomber and seen as this hero among their people.
But that maybe could also be a sign that they're getting a little disillusioned.
Possibly.
Like, you know what? Things didn't turn out so great for Kenny. You know, maybe.
Maybe they get some internet and they discover that there's a whole world out there.
Yeah. Well, they say there's still about 14,000 to 18,000 ISIS members in Iraq and Syria, and the figure includes up to 3,000 foreigners. But yeah, other than that, I don't know. I take the cows as a good sign, kind of. Maybe people see them ambling over, they grab their buns, the patties are about to be flying.
It's definitely lunch. Good. All of a sudden, the fucking cow blows up and Salt Bay shows up and starts like salting
sprinkling
it
and
shit.
It and then
all right, let's move on to round five before we say anything we really regret.
Truly.
Mm-hmm. Andy Guy, I believe that he is an Army officer, and he was going out on PT on Monday. But he said, like many other different leaders, whenever you have group PT, you check to see what the forecast is going to be, so you could tell your people what to show up in. I think this more happens in like October, November timeframe, because you don't know if it's going to be cold in the morning.
Right.
So you're going to say the uniform of the day is sweats, the uniform of the day is shorts, like whatever it's going to be. Mm. So you check out the weather just so everybody's uniform, everybody looks the same, and also see if it's going to rain. Cons, I want to start with you to get your philosophy on this. You get 100% chance of rain for PT. Are you telling them to meet you in the gym, or are you canceling it?
I think I'm adjusting and doing something that would be more productive, because I think when you're doing PT in the rain, you're just not getting as much out of your soldiers. And I know the whole saying in the military, if it ain't raining, we ain't training. I think that's all well and good. And I'm not suggesting that like this doesn't make you tough if you don't want to work out in the rain. I just think it's smarter that you can get more out of your people if you're not subjecting them to adverse conditions, if you have another option. If there's no other option, like if you don't have a gym to get into and do other things, then yeah, sorry, you got to get out there. You got to do PT in the rain. Maybe you shorten it a little bit, but overall, try to be smart.
Catherine?
Pussy ass bitch.
Yeah, there you go.
What kind of army are you running? My guys be out in the rain all day. They be in a twister. So I think you're stupid. Anyways, I think I don't know, just from my experience, we just stupidly still go out running or something in it anyway, which seemed to be the way things just ran. And those are always the days I forgot my PT belt, the days that it was dark and gray and foggy.
Because I think also, too, people will point to the fact that, oh, that's what builds mental toughness and that's morale builder when everyone comes together and still acts like that. I think you're going to be presented with enough scenarios where – that's going to happen and it's going to be out of your control. So when you are presented with a scenario that you can have a little control over, adjust fire and do that.
I remember looking back on my career, the days that we started PT and we would go for a run when it was raining, whenever we started, those days fucking suck.
Right. Then you're like, just setting up the day to be crappy all day.
It sucks. And there is something to be said about you have to push through whenever it sucks. The converse side of that, when you're doing PT and then it starts to rain, those are the most fun days.
Yeah.
Like, because it's cool. Like, you can rock. Like, I used to love it. We used to constantly do it in Okinawa. If we started PT and then it started to rain, we immediately switched it to a McMap session where everybody was doing, like, Marine Corps martial arts and shit like that, where you were rolling on the ground. You were doing threes, 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 like where you fight three people in a row for 3 minutes. Those days were so much fun.
I would agree.
Like, getting wet, getting muddy when you weren't expecting to. If you know you're going to do it, it stinks. Like, even obstacle courses. I used to love obstacle courses most of the time. But if you knew that you had to go to the obstacle course that was mud, there's barbed wire and shit like that, that kind of sucks when you know that you're going to do it.
Right.
When it pops out of nowhere and you get to get muddy and you're like, this is what we fucking do. Yeah, this is why we signed up.
You get a case of the fuck it.
Right. Because there's going to be plenty of time. When you're in the field and you're going to get a really crummy weather day in the field. I remember one time we were in the field in Texas and we got snow and that sucked. That was a morale killer. And there was obviously nothing we could do. You can't just leave the field with your entire battalion.
Then you look like a bitch.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, bitch. Exactly. Yeah. But in this scenario, just be a little smart about things.
Well, I liked the tweet exchanges that came from this because that came from the Army officer asking, you know, he put a poll on Twitter. Do I hold PT or do I cancel because it's going
to
rain?
And he said he was going to hold himself to it, too.
Right.
Like, whatever the results were, he was going to do it. And the results came up before Kate gets into the responses. There's 4,020 people who voted. Only 52% said cancel. 48% said hold PT in the gym. You got to be more creative than hold PT in the gym because everybody else is going to be holding PT in the gym,
Good
too.
Point.
Indeed.
Good point.
You're right. It's going to be
But crowded. Also, cancel shouldn't have been an option. You should never just cancel PT altogether.
I disagree. Kate.
So some people, the exchanges were kind of fun. This little thread right here, Brett Bardo said, hold PT outside and make it fun. To which Sig Velma
said. And everyone that's saying things like that, you could tell by their profile picture or their avatars and shit like that, they've been
Air
out
Force.
For a while.
Oh, that
they've
too.
Been
yeah.
out for, like, oh, back in my core.
Oh, right. Yeah, for sure. Well, we'll get to that in a second. And then somebody replied to him and said, yeah, if it ain't raining, we ain't training. Do a free fun run in the rain.
Fun run.
That's the best.
What does that mean?
Just don't run if it's lightning. And this, I mean, the person's avatar there is Velma from Scooby-Doo, so I don't know where they served. And then somebody replied to the, if it ain't raining, we ain't training. There's always one jackass that says that, says Deaf Jolene, who's totally definitely Jolene. And then this exchange I like, what units change PT if it's raining? Said every infantryman in the history of the world in unison. That was DZ Bill Fulton, total hardo. To which another hardo jumped right in.
Oh my God, this is a big time
Daniel Jordan
hardo
said, ran 8 miles in Alaska, minus 40 degrees, and 6 miles with pneumonia at the church in basic. Yeah, better be raining the Mississippi River.
Yeah,
I don't know what
guy.
That means.
Wow.
But
minus 40?
Yeah.
No. No, it was not minus 40. Hate to tell you, buddy.
You would be dead.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Daniel J. Duran wins our hardo of the week.
Reservoir.
Yeah, exactly.
Even if you are, that's irresponsible.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Here's when I think it's okay to cancel PT. Mm. When it's a perfectly sunny day out, everyone gets the formation and say, you know what? No PT today on a Friday or whatever. No PT. And, you know,
what do you guys call that? Gonk?
I don't know.
Zonk?
Zonk.
Zonk.
Zonk. Yeah.
Get out of
oh,
here.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Sure. Because if you cancel because of weather, I think that's soft.
All right. Here's my philosophy. I ran it by Kate a little bit earlier. And this really probably shows that I've gotten kinder and gentler over the years.
Mm-hmm.
I'm of the impression that because most military units PT Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
Right.
Like, that's your PT schedule. During the college football – or during football season, if I was still in now, I would tell my folks, we're going to adjust to Tuesday, Wednesday – Friday PT schedule. You're going to come into work early on 4 days instead of 3 days. Mondays are going to be leadership development. We're going to have a breakfast together on Mondays. You're not going to have the Sunday scaries. You got to get here at 7 o'clock and we're going to do lessons in leadership.
I like that.
Pussy ass bitch. You dumb, stupid idiot with army. Man. Sheesh.
I say that now like it'd be a good idea, but I know by like week three when the Lance Corporals walk in, like, fucking Stassorn running his goddamn mouth again. We get it, dude. You read.
Yeah. I feel like, it would come across great at first, but they would find a way to be mad about it eventually.
Oh, man.
You just can't win.
All right, let's move on to round six. All right, so for round number six, I want to preface a story that I don't think I've ever actually told what happened on the podcast.
Oh, no, you didn't.
I want to get into it because I'm not on this interview. And do I want to do this?
Yeah. No,
you got a full year of
okay.
Of time since all right.
And it wasn't intentional.
Exactly.
It was a complete accident. It was a complete accident. So when I came up to New York, last year around 9/11. Yeah, same time. And we had scheduled Large, who you're going to hear his unbelievably touching 9/11 story, and it is incredible. So stick around and listen to it for sure. But whenever I was going to lead the interview like normal, that morning our guy Donnie Does, who had just came in from Colorado, I didn't know this. When I sat down at a desk, because a lot of the folks who live out in town, we kind of share a desk. Usually it's PFT's desk in the
back
morning.
Back at the old Barstool headquarters.
Back at the old
everything
Barstool.
Everything was cramped. No one really had their own space.
Exactly. So when I get there, there's a packet of gummy bears that are just sitting on the desk. And so I love gummy bears. Mm-hmm. I'm well on the record of saying that I'm a big gummy bear guy.
And there was no label on it. It was no just like label. A plastic Ziploc bag of delicious.
But because he
bears.
Was flying back from Colorado, he had put THC gummies in a normal gummy bear bag. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not looking. And people, when I've said this before, they're like, oh, it says how many milligrams of THC. Like, you're fucking reading your gummy bear?
Right.
Like, no, you're just popping them in your mouth. Well, I popped in like four at a time, which is an aggressive move, I admit. And then whenever I was swallowing it, I could taste like the little bit of THC. Like, you know, it does have that distinct taste.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, my God. When I got downstairs to do this interview with you guys and Large, it had been probably 45 minutes, so just long enough for it to kick in.
Oh, yeah.
I sit down with Large, and we turn on the mics, and I'm telling them, I'm pretty high right now. I don't know if I can do this.
Yeah, and you didn't expect to be high, so it was like, I am high out of the blue, out of the clouds.
Yeah.
And we're about to talk about 9/11 for
like
an hour.
So it's like the worst possible subject to be talking about.
Right.
So I think that I'm like, all right, now we got Large on 0 Block 30. So 9/11, tell us about that.
Yeah.
And then he starts, I'm like, nope, I gotta go.
Yeah.
So I went, I immediately stop it. How far did we get in? Maybe
not
question. Even a minute.
No, it was a pretty immediate.
Pretty, and I was like, I can't do this. Which credit to me for not trying.
Yeah, it was great that you
it.
Recognized that and removed yourself, because then we were able to have a very serious conversation, and you'll hear it in
because I'm
interview.
Not a weed guy.
Like, no,
I'm not a weed guy at all. So whenever I went back to the hotel, I lay down on the bed. It was the spinniest room I've ever been in.
Oh, yeah.
I was so high that I felt like I had to pee but could get nothing out.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Wow, we've all been there, buddy.
Yeah.
Anyway, here's a chat with Large.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's the chat that I wish I would have been a part of with Large.
I was arrested. Now you know that. Way back in my early 20s. Lovely drunk in public. As
similar situation. I was also arrested seventh grade. I spent the night in the 6-1, the 61st precinct of Coney Island Avenue.
Seventh grade.
Yeah, it was
started early.
Yeah. I don't mean to brag, but yeah, I was a youth delinquent.
He got me beat. I was like, I had a drunken public at college, and he was like, well, check this out, seventh grade.
Right.
But we ended up telling all sorts of different stories, and one thing that I was blown away by, I didn't know about you, was that you have a very close connection to September 11th. And we're really grateful that you're here today to share that story with us, because we know that it's definitely a heavy one. And with the anniversary, as the show drops on September 11th, thank you for coming to share your story.
No problem. I started to write a blog last night about it. And it winds up being longer than I thought it was. And it was the first time like I actually went down the timeline, because I forgot of what time the first plane hit, what time the second plane hit. But, you know, where I was in New York City was I was 10 blocks north of the North Tower in Citigroup's building, because that's where I worked at the time.
Right. Well, yeah, because we always take for granted that everyone knows everyone.
Right.
Prior to joining Barstool, Large had a very illustrious career on Wall Street.
Yeah, so I slept my way to the middle of the finance world. So I had worked 25 years on the street before I decided to do this for some reason. And when 2001, when 9/11 had occurred, I worked for Citigroup. I was a position trader for them on their equity cash desk. Mm-hmm. So I was in 390 Greenwich. Is it okay if I got right to it? I was 10 minutes. I was 10 blocks north. My wife was a broker on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange at the time. So she was 3 blocks south.
Right.
So we were positioned on either side of the towers. My wife, I had met her because I worked for her dad on the floor of the American Stock Exchange. And then I soon began sleeping with the boss's daughter, right? Which is a cute thing to say, but that's what I did.
That's always a good right. strategy.
Got arrested in the 7th grade, slept with the boss's daughter when I first got to Wall Street. So anyway.
Hope everyone's taking notes.
Yeah, whirlwind romance. So we were, when I worked for her dad, his name is Rick Harvey, he belonged to an eating club at the top of the North Tower where Winners of the World was. It was called Wild Blue. And Wild Blue was the greatest because they did all these wine tastings and special theme meals. And we used to take customers there quite a bit. And every Tuesday we had our Tuesday morning breakfast there. Members of the American Stock Exchange, New York Stock Exchange, we'd meet up there and have a great breakfast at the best view of the city in the world. I mean, there was nothing like Jersey looked great. I mean, like everything was.
Which is sometimes tough to do.
It even made Jersey look good.
Right, right. Yeah. And so nothing but fond memories of Winners of the World, and I was lucky enough to spend every Tuesday morning there. I eventually transferred out. I started working for J.P. Morgan, a couple of places, and I started working for Citigroup. My wife was still working on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, and we were living together in Brooklyn. We were married at the time. And so my wife had a root canal on Monday, and so she didn't go to breakfast on Tuesday. So instead, I drove her to the New York Stock Exchange. I dropped her off. I went north to Citigroup. And, you know, I went to work and I was interviewing somebody, you know, a little bit after 8 o'clock, I think maybe around 8:40-ish and or 8:46. And the first plane hits the North Tower. So it shakes Citigroup's building and they start to evacuate. But I didn't leave. Most of the traders didn't leave, but we were glued to a TV.
And what are your thoughts right at this point when you see one plane hit a tower?
So we see the plane. There's an older gentleman. His name is George Levine. He was our Bloomberg representative. George was an absolute gentleman. He lived for 10 years in the Drake Hotel in Chicago. Like, he was just a classic old school guy. Mm-hmm. He won a chicken ranch and a bet, like, you know, like that type of stuff.
Right.
And he told me about it. He mailed me a coffin full of, like, air-dried chickens. You know, he's just so he said, oh, somebody fell asleep at the wheel. This is terrible. Right. And then somebody else had said, no, it's a terrorist. And back then, that wasn't your go-to. 2001, we were still a little bit innocent.
Yeah.
So now, you know, an M80 goes off in a schoolyard, and you automatically think sleeper cell. Mm-hmm. But back then, you know, accidents happened. But then not soon afterwards, when people got out, and from our vantage point, since the plane came from the north and hit the North Tower, going south, so the hole that it left in the building was a perfect vantage point from 390 Greenwich, where we were. So everyone who had hit the streets that was looking up at this, you know, smoldering hole in the building got to see then a plane come from the south and hit the South Tower. And even though it was on the opposite side, that was a big enough explosion. I don't know if people remember this, but the South Tower was the first to fall, even though it was the second to get hit.
Yes.
The North Tower burned for 102 minutes before it fell. So South Tower gets hit, and now everyone knows that we're under attack. So they're now evacuating Citigroup, the building, traders and everything, security. But they can't get me out because I have direct wires to the floor of the New York Stock Exchange from speaking to my wife, who's telling me how she knows her dad's up top and her uncle and all the guys we started the business with. So her uncle Bob is my best friend and so all these guys. So they're all up top above where the blast went in. And just if you knew, in, you know, World Trade Center, there were no outside staircases.
Right.
No.
So, and, you know, I'd learned later on that there was like a 15 floor fire that was burning at 2,000 degrees or something I can't get my arms around. So there's no way. But you still were hoping.
Yeah.
And so we decided that we were going to try to meet at the Downtown Athletic Club and then we'd figure out a plan of attack to get home. So I had left the Citigroup. I started walking south. And when I started walking south, that's when the first tower fell.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the ash and stuff. I ran to the water as we were being, you know, followed by ash. And like a cop in front of me dropped his gun. I swooped down to try and get it, but it slipped. I always wanted a gun.
Yeah.
And I just kept running until we got to the railing. Like, we were all pressed against the railing. And then the ash hit us. And then we all turned around for the first time. And then the Twin Tower had lost its wind. Like, that was the first time we saw a single tower. So then we pushed back up north. And you know, I was able to kind of get in touch with her because cell phones were terrible back then. But I called like my parents and she'd call my parents. So we kind of made a plan, tentative plan to meet on the other side of either the Brooklyn or the Manhattan Bridge. And but like the tower that her dad was in was still standing. Mm-hmm. And then that one fell. Yeah. So and then when the North Tower fell, you know, we knew that everything had gone to shit. So we did wind up getting to the Brooklyn side, and that's where we eventually met up. I was unable to get my car out of the city. My car was actually in Ground Zero, so I wasn't able to get my car for over a week. And, you know, it was caked in ash by the time I got down there. Like, it's – and, you know, like, as I'm talking about this day, like, I can't help but remember how beautiful that day was. Like,
yeah. It was gorgeous. I remember it was my first day of school.
Right.
Senior year of high school. And it was an absolute gorgeous, sunny Tuesday – September day. It was unbelievable.
Like, you know, like today it's all dreary and whatnot, and I think tomorrow it's supposed to warm up. But like I had sat down like just to catch my breath, and like I looked out again like across at Jersey, so there was no ash going that way because the wind was blowing. I think the wind was blowing east that day. Mm-hmm. So the majority of the smoke was getting pushed towards Brooklyn. So you looked at it. I was like, my God, this is just, you know, it was a great day until it wasn't.
Surreal.
So then we met on the other side, and then everything kind of fell apart. Like, you know, we went to the armory the next day to look. There were seven members of her firm, her dad, her uncle, Pat Dickinson, Tommy Sullivan, Bobby Sutcliffe, Mike Pascuma Jr., Rudy Backus, and then two other guys that used to work for her father who unluckily just took a new job, both of them at Stern AG. So Mike Timuccio and John Schroeder, they all died. We were at the armory going through lists of people that they recovered to see if we can come up with anything. And Fox News had heard that there was somebody from the floor there because nobody from the floor of the New York or the American Stock Exchange died because people think like the exchange has something to do with the World Trade Center.
Sure, right. Yeah.
It doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the only members of either exchange to die were my father-in-law's company. Mm-hmm. So Fox News asked my wife to come in that night just to, because we're looking for bodies. There were all these rumors that somebody passed out and they were brought to, you know, someplace in New Jersey and they could be alive, or that they were pulling people out of the rubble, which, you know, for the most part wasn't true. You know, like you saw some of the logs that people were putting online of names, and like the logs, some of them said like Elvis Presley, Jim Morrison. So even like people were screwing around that.
Right.
But we were hopeful. So she'd gone to the TV studio, Fox News. And the only thing that she could bring was our wedding album, which we had married about a year and a half before. And so she was showing pictures. It's my dad. If you saw him, this is Uncle Bob. If you saw him, this is Pat Dickinson. This is Bobby. Most of the pictures had me in them because it was my wedding.
Right.
So you fast forward a couple months and we start going to memorials and funerals for people within the community. And I'd show up my wife. And everyone who saw me, like, they were like, oh, my God. You know, like, they'd run up to me, and they were like, you know, Lodge, we thought you were dead. Like,
we thought you were gone. Sure.
Because I was part of that thing. So somebody would see Annie, and they'd be like, look at Annie. And, like, they didn't realize that I wasn't dead. So, you know, sooner or later, we went to Red Cross, and she swabbed, and her mom swabbed, and they took her mom's DNA out of her. And that was enough for them to be left with her dad's DNA. And they went in and they found a couple of pieces of her father, and it was enough for us to cremate. And then we said, we're going to stop with that because it became like a morbid jigsaw puzzle.
Sure.
So it was enough for us. But that wasn't for 9 months. We didn't retrieve any parts of her dad.
Wow.
It sounds terrible to say, but we didn't retrieve any pieces of my father-in-law for 9 months. And then in the interim, because it was the only people on either exchange, they did a huge memorial in St. Patrick's Cathedral, which fits maybe, you know, 2,000 people. But I think there was four. Because it was packed. And my wife was a single person to eulogize all nine men, which is huge.
Wow, that's unbelievable.
So she got up there. I stood behind her crying. Like, I looked like just this giant Asian. Like, I was so swollen and stuff. And so she went up there and she killed it. And then...
And I've had the pleasure of meeting your wife. She's really a very powerful, strong woman.
Yeah.
So it's
she's
not
extraordinary.
That she was able to do that.
And then, you know, like, I wrote a story, a blog about a gentleman whose funeral that I attended... a couple of years back, John Mulhern, and like he came out afterwards and helped us with the dissolution of my father-in-law's partnerships. Mm-hmm. Like people had come to our help, but one of the big people that came to our help was this guy Jules, who ran Windows of the World, and he wasn't there that day because he did the dinner thing. And he had known me from when I worked for Rick, so he reached out to me, as we're at my father-in-law's house and we're all like looking through websites and all this stuff to find out where we could get him. And he's like, listen, I see him on the book. I see they haven't left. He's like, I can tell you right now, your father-in-law's and everyone who was up there, like, cause they had like almost attendance. Mm-hmm. So he gave us the benefit, a tough phone call to make, but he gave us the benefit of giving up hope. So we no longer were looking for people. We started looking for bodies.
Right.
But you know, so you fast forward now and 9/11 stinks for us because it's, I mean, I don't know how it would be like if my father died in a car crash and they showed that car crash on TV continuously once a year, you know? But you know, like my son has read the names down in Ground Zero. You know, we've had some positives as far as that goes. That museum down there is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for, you know, and I know people are affected a lot more than my family and I, but that museum is wonderful. If you're ever on Thames Street in between Greenwich Place and Greenwich Street and Trinity, that's now Emmerich Harvey Place. It's named after my father-in-law. Like, you know, and that's on the corner of the American Stock Exchange where he spent, you know, 40 years of his life.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, we cope and stuff, but this is one of those weeks, like, I won't be in the office tomorrow.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I know having it be a national holiday is not realistic. You know, this time of year, you know, Jewish holiday, Labor Day and all that stuff. You can't, like, squeeze something in, but it is for us, you know, like, we'll probably send the kids to school and then we'll just kind of lay around and kind of turn off all the TVs and stuff like that.
So let me ask you then, what do you think the response should be, or how do you react to how everyone now treats 9/11 17 years later? Because I think everyone still honors everyone's memory, but we're 17 years removed from it. It's not as the wound isn't as fresh as it was in 2002, 3, 4. So what is your reaction to that?
Well, I think
obviously yours being a lot different than the rest of
right.
The
so I mean, I think when you're in New York, there's still a proper respect towards it. It's gotten less and less. I mean, there's never been an 9/11 sale at Old Navy, 2-for-1 Capri's. Like, they've never done anything like that, which, you know, for people sometimes might frown on that for Memorial Day or, you know, some. So they don't do anything disrespectful. But I do see that every year a little less coverage comes. Like, I think last year was the first year that it didn't make the front page on 9/11. And it wasn't like, it wasn't something that was that big, you know, like it was, you know, not Kim K gets a surgery or anything like that, but there was something else where 9/11 was like the second page in New York. That's not acceptable.
Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a bad thing. Like, I think as much as I say that my wife needs to go into hiding for that day just to keep her sanity, I think the whole never forget, I think the whole never forget credo is probably true, right? Because if we listen, nobody is going to let this happen again, right? Although there's a good chance that it does because of all the stuff. And that's why having Rob O'Neill on last week on my radio show was so, by the way, it's my radio show now, apparently. But no, but having her on Barstool Breakfast was so huge for me. And then having my wife meet him at a charity function the week before, she molested him.
Yeah.
I mean, she straight up, he was defenseless and he's a trained killer. Like, she could, and you know,
means a lot.
But yeah, like I don't need it to be, I like to avoid it, but I see less and less of it. So this whole new generation of kids, like these kids who are the interns this year, if it was 17 years ago, these kids were five.
No concept of
and,
it really.
And if they're coming from Youngstown, Ohio or something like that,
sure,
they really don't know. And I don't know, like Pearl Harbor, how long that took before it sort of faded into Bolivia. But I mean, I don't know what the timeline is with 9/11, but it's an especially you know, sore wound for me.
Yeah.
So I don't mind. I'll avoid it, but like my kids will always know about it. Like they'll have the benefit, and you know, they've rang the bell on the New York Stock Exchange on 9/11. They said they did the names, and when my son did the names, he was only 10.
Yeah.
And they gave him some doozies. Like they really didn't plan for it. Like not a lot.
They knew he was advanced.
Yeah.
So this kid's got it.
But I think I agree with you. I think in New York it'll always obviously be.
I love the Towers of Light.
Oh, it's so gorgeous.
Yeah, I get chills so when powerful. I see it.
Yeah. Right. But I mean, just each year, and even hearing you now tell this story, it'll always, I think, give me chills, and it'll still always move me just because of the profound impact it then had on my life from that day forward.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to what you said about becoming friendly with Rob O'Neill, do you think that has helped with you and your wife at all? You know, kind of maybe brought it full circle?
Right. Like, I really thought that it might not be the healthiest thing in the world for her. Mm-hmm. But it was, I hate to give it such a juvenile thing as like a bucket list. Because it's not. But she, you know, like when you think about Japanese culture, the idea of avenging your father's death or your father-in-law's death mm-hmm. is like, you know, not that I've all of a sudden turned into a Ronin overnight. Mm-hmm. But like Rob O'Neill is the guy who killed the guy who killed my father-in-law. And so when my wife met him, I mean, she was absolutely overcome. And she's like, I said, okay, and we're going to try to get out to dinner with his wife and stuff. And she's like, believe me, just getting me to meet him was enough. It really was like something where she checked the box emotionally, more so than me checking a box when I finished a 64-ounce steak or something like that. Like she really did check a box emotionally. So, and I think Rob understands that. Like, I think he's had a lot of people in that situation. Mm-hmm. So he intimated something to her from that night, like sort of whispered in her ear. And maybe it's common knowledge, maybe it's not, but it gave her the impression that, you know, she was on the inside a little bit. Like, you know what I mean? Like, because, you know, you talk about overwhelming hatred. We never like to blame many for the actions of few. So we were never the type to just write off the whole Middle East. But when we heard news that there were people dancing in the streets in Brooklyn, like some, you know, Arab cultures and stuff like
Patterson,
that.
In Jersey. Yeah. That was tough.
It made us angry, and it makes you a little bit racist, and it makes you a little bit stupid. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that I'm glad to say that that's, you know, been tempered. I still won't eat halal on 9/11. I won't eat sushi on December 7th. Like, you know what I mean? Like that whole thing, because I'm an idiot. But, you know, there is no far reaching thing. But what we did hate was this one guy. Yeah. So then to have him get three put in his head, you know, to where they had to piece his head back together, take a picture.
Yeah.
Not
mad about that.
No, and it meant everything.
Not too upset about that one.
For my wife to meet him. Yeah. You know, so it was that was a win-win for me.
Absolutely. Wow.
Yeah. On my radio show.
I just went down there this past weekend, and I've been through the museum three times now, and every single time it absolutely blows me away. Like you said, they did such a great job with it. I think they did a really beautiful job, especially considering, too, like so much input and so much feeling and emotion that had to be a difficult thing to, you want to get it so right. But I think they did a good job, and walking around there always just kind of takes your breath away when you look at the scale of it. The one thing that I love is the survivor tree down there.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that?
I haven't been there. I want to go.
I've only been once.
Yeah, I would love to go.
I was there 6 months ago because we had friends in from California and they were like, we want to go down. Mm-hmm. I was like, I don't know if I went to California, if the first thing I'd want to see is something like, you know, like take me to the Irish Famine Museum. Like I would never want to have that kind of bring down. I want to go to, you know, best chili dog in town or something.
Yeah.
Like that. But we did go down there. So that was the second time my wife had gone down, the first time I had gone down. And because we had a family member who passed away, I don't know if you know this, we had a VIP thing. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge line. It's a very big tourist attraction.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We go right through and you get like a white glove treatment, which is wonderful, right? Yeah. I mean, that's very nice for like somebody who had a situation where they feel like they're more entitled to walk through a memorial than everybody else, than somebody wearing an I Love New York t-shirt. Mm-hmm. And they give the families that.
That's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And I mean, it really is such a beautiful memorial. Yeah. I mean, what's your reaction to what they did down there?
With
the memorial and everything.
So, yeah. So I have the whole area.
I have
kind of a problem. So I love the Towers of Light.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I love the memorial.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like Freedom Tower. I don't think it fits. Like, I don't think it fits Lower Manhattan. I think it should be in, like, you know, I don't know, like an Arab Emirates type thing, like one of those more silky type buildings.
Yep.
I don't know why they didn't put up two towers. Like, I don't know why the Twin Towers got knocked down. They put up the Freedom Tower, and it took them so many years to build. You know, like, I think that American ingenuity and, like, our stick-it-to-em-ness, if that's a word or it is now, should have had them make one tower 9 feet taller, one tower 11 foot taller, and they just look like two big middle fingers pointing right at the Middle East. Like, I thought that that would be the most fitting thing. Like, you know, God, send them over again. We'll throw them up even higher. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? And not... Right. And I didn't mean to be like juvenile and say, well, cover them in pork or anything like that. But I wanted that to happen.
Yeah.
And then when this thing happened.
Yeah. I'm with you. I don't really like the way it looks. I mean, it's a nice attempt at a symbol to say that, hey, you can knock us down, but we're going to come right back up.
Right.
But at the same time, I would agree with your sentiment that it's not, I don't think it's the best way they could have done that.
And cons, I grew up across, like, so I grew up across the river in Brooklyn, as you know, from our food tour.
I do. Yeah.
And by the way, it was a very detailed food tour. I think we got into the whole thing. So yes. Like, so Kate and Chaps had gotten intimate because cons wasn't invited to like exactly where I was. So I stared across, and I went to high school in Lower East Side. Like, I stared across Manhattan, and I looked at those goddamn buildings.
Right.
And I didn't wonder at them every day. Mm-hmm. But with them not there now, it's crazy.
Yeah.
It's very weird. It's always eerie, too, when you see them in old TV shows and old movies.
Old movies,
and
you're like,
yeah.
Oh, my God. Right. So for 30 years to see them, and then for the last 17 not, and instead now seeing this thing, I just don't think it fit. It's not the skyline, like the way that the skyline used to be. Mm-hmm. And even the newer stuff that goes up that I think kind of, you know, doesn't belong in the skyline because I'm an old man. But like the way the skyline used to be, to have that anchor, like those two towers as an anchor.
Mm-hmm.
And now not like now to have that other thing still just bothers me. And it doesn't bother me that FIDI is built up so much and all the millennials live there, or not like not even the millennials, but like the people in the financial industry who just started, they all have apartments
right
back
there.
Where I traded.
Yeah.
And, you know, that whole, I mean, there are people who've sold houses when they found out it was on an Indian burial ground. I mean, they are on top of the detritus of thousands of dead bodies. So, like, I never really felt strongly about that. Like, I guess that's mm-hmm. fine. But the tower itself, the Freedom Tower itself, bugs me.
What do you think about this statue? I think it's such a cool statue. The horse soldier memorial statue. Have you seen that?
No,
down
I don't
there?
Know. No.
It's a statue that memorializes our special operations soldiers who were the first ones to go into Afghanistan October of 2001, right after 9/11. And they actually just, there was a book written, 12 Strong. The movie was made, 12 Strong, where these guys went in on horseback, really primitive, just because that was the only way that they could get to the enemy. So my question to you, though, is what do you think about the military in general and our response since 9/11? Because I don't think you have much military in your family, being the son of immigrants.
None.
Right. So, right. I mean, what was your feeling about the military prior to and then post 9/11?
So I've always had an overwhelming respect for the military. When my dad came over here, he was 19, came over from Ireland. And but my mom came over when she was much younger. She was 12 or 13. So she actually grew up 12, 13 on. And then her brother wound up going to Vietnam and doing a bunch of tours and became a sniper, Marine sniper. And then when he came back, he was damaged goods, right? So he went down the wrong path with drug addiction and stuff like that, and eventually led to his death. So I've always had that thing, like, I'm not letting my kids go down that path, just because the only person in my family who did it, and we still have the picture of him with his handsome, you know, the white hat and stuff like that, but we know what happened to him. And then you fast forward, and my wife has a cousin who had graduated, and he was the first graduating class that was sent right overseas.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what year it was, but when we were up for a game, like, people were saying, oh, I'm class of this, and he said, oh, I'm class of this, maybe 2002.
Yeah.
And everyone went right away, all the other Army guys, all the other West Point guys were like, oh, thank you for your service. Like, they knew he was the first class out.
Right.
And he came back, damaged goods, eventually found CrossFit and found the right woman and found like this.
Right.
And so he's totally 100%. But I've only had that history of seeing people get ruined by the military.
Sure.
So I've always told my kids, I guess I'll break your leg or, you know, like that. Like that type. And I'm also a natural coward. So I wouldn't, who's never been able to do a chin up. So I knew that I wasn't military grade. My brothers are much tougher than me, so they could have. So I've had this like tertiary relationship to the military, but I've become such a patriot since 9/11, and all my friends that are anywhere near the military, two of my roommates at school were ROTC, Air Force ROTC, Air Force, whatever. And they went, you know, and one of them is a lifer there now. And so we get like little tidbits from him and stuff like that. We're an extremely patriotic family. I mean, for a first generation Irish American family, and my wife is very conservative. She's very Republican. Mm-hmm. She is a huge like military. So my kids, you know, like we're extremely respectful with the whole deal. And I wasn't necessarily, I was more selfish.
Sure.
I didn't care. I mean, I love, you know, military movies, but that was it. I didn't have a love for the military that I do now since that time.
Right.
So as far as what we should be doing, if we should still be over there or whatever that is, you know, it's above my pay grade, which is a military term, I think. But my family, as
one of the better results of it, have become big military lovers. It's the only reason I hang out with you guys. I feel like I always
He spent a lot of money on our Brooklyn food tour on oysters and stuff, and only to hear me be like, I don't eat oysters. You can't be mad at me because I was in the military.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
It's an unwritten rule.
That trump card.
Yeah.
But, so if you could leave everyone that's listening with one thought for 9/11 that they should take with them each year when 9/11 comes, what would that thought be?
Well, you know, like, so on 9/10/2001, right? You know, my wife and I had zero cares in the world. And we're married 20 years. We have three beautifully expensive kids. But, you know, like, all of a sudden on 9/10, and then on 9/12, when we moved on after 9/11, like, we still realize that every time my son just started playing high school football Saturday. And his grandfather would have loved that.
Right.
So, you know, like, it, without getting too sappy, like, you really don't know what you have, right, until it's taken away. Mm-hmm. And it gets taken away in the fucking blink of an eye. Right.
Yeah.
So, like, as a result, we've circled the wagons as a family. We've become, like, our core five. Nobody else gets to screw with us. Like, it's made us stronger, mm-hmm. which, you know, and we think about stuff, you know, and plus the friends that we lost, too, like, outside of the family, because I'm a New Yorker.
Right.
From,
yeah.
Right. So it's like I didn't even have time to remember that they had died. There were so many funerals.
Yeah.
So I think we now take a list of everything that's special to us. And we're more thankful for it because we know that, you know, it's going to be 9/12 again, mm-hmm. you know, someday, you know, and right. something. It's going to be 12/23 one day, and mm-hmm. it's going to be after the 12/22 bombing or something like that. And there's those bombings, which used to be once in a lifetime now, mm-hmm. are twice a year. So, you know, it's made us a little bit thankful and stuff like that. So kind of look around, like
yeah.
even like your parents, and think about what it would be like if they just happened to be enjoying a beautiful breakfast and windows of the world when some, you know,
yeah.
clumsy fucking asshole decided to drive a plane through it.
Yeah.
I've taken stock in my life since then, and I encourage people to do the same.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on and
my
sharing
pleasure.
That story.
A little bit heavy, right?
Really, really appreciate it. And I think I owe you a Brooklyn food tour now after this.
Oh, yeah,
I think
yeah.
I definitely, yeah. maybe some martinis yeah. in there. But thank you, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for
yeah,
the invite.
Thanks, Large. And I'm coming on the next tour.
Yeah.
The next food tour.
Yeah,
yeah.
Just invited yourself.
Squirrel on my way in there. I don't give a shit. I'm coming.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Yeah, definitely grateful that he shared that story with us. And he said that he had never really done that before. He had never sat down and gone through the entire thing before. So I know that's not easy for people to do, but sure.
And he's told me since that it was really like cathartic for him to
yeah.
sit down and like get all the story out.
Mm-hmm. And his wife is one of the most lovely people you could ever meet on the planet. Always love when she's around. So
shout out St. Anne.
Yeah, shout out St. Anne. But just thinking of them and everybody affected this week and all the first responders and we have the bright light that shines up starting on September 1st. I can see it from my bedroom. So you look out and you see it coming up from ground zero and just keeping them in my thoughts.
There's a solid written piece that Large did last year. I believe it was the number one blog by K Marco makes a list at the end of the year. I think it ended up being the number one blog. So mm-hmm. if you go back and search that, you can find Large's blog that goes along with it really well.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I think one of my favorite aspects about this story now is it obviously doesn't take away the pain from 9/11, but the joy that I saw and relief when you see the picture of Annie with Rob O'Neill.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Is just awesome.
Yeah.
Like, it's just
cool,
awesome.
And speaking
cool
of pictures like that and just the remembering the date, have either of you ever been to the 9/11 Museum?
Three times.
So I've been once.
Overachiever.
I know.
No. So, but I've been once. I spent 3.5 hours in there and it didn't feel like enough. I feel like I'm going to probably go back at some point. So if you're listening to this and you're either in New York City or you're traveling to New York City, I would suggest to anyone to make it a point to go there. It's very easy to get tickets. Block off a significant amount of time because you're going to want it. There's just so much in there to consume. And I think it's important to remember all those people and just to see that in that setting, I think is very powerful and moving. So I would suggest that place to anybody.
No doubt about it. Before we get into save rounds, I also want to talk a little bit about a golden goose that one of our guys from Barstool Chicago got the chance to see. None other than the warrior monk himself, General James Mattis. He was in the airport.
Mm-hmm.
Chief saw him, went up to him, told him a little bit about ZBT, told him that we've been talking about him, talking about his op-ed, talking about his book a little bit, and he said that he was going to become a ZBT listener, which I'm super pumped about.
He said he was going to give us a listen. I just love that we've wanted to meet him forever, but instead the Barstool Chicago guys meet him when they're hungover on the way back from a Bears loss.
Not just hungover. They had just done Barstool Breakfast Gentleman's Friday, so they were somewhat drunk probably.
They were a little ripped when they met him. But I love the picture of Chief with his arm around General Mattis like they're best buds. General Mattis has his hands deep in his pockets, which is classic Mattis. And I think White Sox Dave got to meet him. They all got to meet him. So I'm happy for them, and I'm glad that they gave us a
shout-out. Hopefully we get to meet him, but it's in the studio next time. If you're listening, sir, come on the fucking show. Please.
Please. We're not desperate.
I think it's important to note, too, that it was Chief who took the picture. Because of all the Barstool Chicago guys, I think it's safe to say, even among the Barstool universe as a whole, he's got the best hair out there in Chicago.
He does.
So it's a good look for us that we put our best foot forward when speaking to Mattis.
True.
Big of you to bring up hair cons.
I know.
Sorry. All right. Let's finish the show. All right. Save rounds, alibis. We'll start with Kate.
Got nothing. Zero.
Cons?
Saturday stung. Appreciated everyone's texts
Next.
And tweets.
Yeah,
we're gonna get over that. But I want to read a tweet, because as you're listening to this, it's the day before 9/11. Possibly some people are listening to it on 9/11, and I saw a tweet and I really liked the sentiment and I just wanted to share it. And this person said, "I had a cubicle in 7 World Trade Center. I had brunch at Windows on the World until 3 weeks before 9/11 when I moved and lost friends. 9/11 hits hard. But I miss 9/12. No fighting about political differences. Flags weren't racist. No one had privilege. We didn't apologize. Just love." And I just, maybe that's overly optimistic and idealist, but I really like that sentiment, especially because I feel, maybe, and this is because we spend so much time on the internet, it just feels like the country's more divided than ever. And I would love if everyone just could take a step back, and instead of maybe trying to dunk on someone on the other side of the political aisle, you just reflect and appreciate all the great things that we do have here and all the great people that are in this country.
All right. My save round is, I am very proud that I am a big boy and took the train by myself.
Tell us about that.
So
I want to hear about that.
I have gotten to the point, because I don't come up to New York nearly as much as I used to. I should probably start doing that more. But normally whenever I land in Newark, I take a taxi, and it's a fucking miserable experience.
You're
terrible.
More often than not, especially because you come in the middle of the day, you're going to hit traffic going into the tunnel, and it's just going to inch along.
It's awful, and it's like people don't know how to drive. They constantly pump on the brakes and gas, and like it's never a smooth ride. Mm-hmm. So today I was like, you know what? I'm going to see if I could take the train, and it was a lovely experience. It was the easiest thing, $12 instead of fucking, I think it's normally like 110.
Right.
Yeah, it's so easy.
Like including tolls and shit.
So I actually hadn't considered. So if you were coming from Newark, it's one train and it goes right to Penn Station, which is now 3 blocks from the office. So
it's
super easy.
Nothing. Yeah. So I got out of the train, went on the little air train from the airport, switched over, and just had to go on one other train. It was the easiest thing I've ever done.
Right.
Congrats.
Yeah. So I feel like a big New York boy.
Yeah.
There you go.
You're a regular city slicker.
I might go get a fucking bagel tomorrow.
There you go.
Silent retreat.